32. On the morning the sheriff finally called to give his permission, Sten was still in bed. A long stripe of bleached-out sunlight painted the wall over the night table, where the clock radio showed 10:30. Carolee was nowhere to be seen. Gone, he remembered, down to Calpurnia to work at the game reserve. Just to get out of the house, because I swear I'm going to start screaming any minute now. He'd taken a sleeping pill in the middle of the night, after something had awakened him. A random noise, a scurrying in the dark. And he'd lain there for what seemed like hours till he got up, made his way to the bathroom and swallowed an Ambien, dry, and then staggered back to bed. When his cell phone weaned him into consciousness, he didn't at first know where he was. His head fogged with the residue of his dreams, dreams that bucked and shifted and left his muscles kinked with anxiety till he felt as if he'd been crawling through a series of decreasingly narrow tubes all night long. He was going to ignore the phone. He was trying to ignore it. 2 weeks more having dragged by since Rob had stopped by the house to quiz him on the subject of Adam's military background. The police presence in the hills inflated till there was a virtual army out there, and still no news, no hope, no reason to do anything but lie flat out on your back, like one of the living dead. But those two sharp bleats, followed by a pause, and another pair of bleats, and then another, were too much for him. He pushed the talk button and heard the sheriff's voice coming at him, a morning voice, caffeinated and urgent. Sten?
Yeah.
Shit, I didn't wake you, did I?
No, I just... You know how it is.
And now all his fears came to squat on his chest like a flock of carrion birds with their long, naked claws.
What's the news? Tell me quick.
No news. Nothing. Zip. No contact. But what I'm calling about is I think it's a good idea, you going out there and see what you can do. We've arranged it with the railroad people. The railroad people. Sure. Of course they'd be involved. Why not? They wanted this thing over with as much as anybody because they'd been shut down now since Adam started in. And that meant no income. No tourists being hauled up the hill by the hundreds and paying $49 apiece for the privilege, which in turn meant that everybody who owned a motel or a restaurant or even a gas station was hurting too. The irony of it. But it was beyond irony. It was like some black-hearted joke the universe was playing on him. If before he couldn't step in the door of a restaurant or coffee shop for fear of some total stranger sending over martinis or picking up his tab, now he didn't dare show his face because of Adam. Because of what Adam had done to Kerry Bachman and Art Tolleson, and what he was doing single-handedly to the local economy. The forests were closed, off-limits. And if the forests were closed, what was the attraction for the tourists? Or anybody else, for that matter? Take back our forests. Right. Take them back from Adam. Can you be ready today? For the afternoon run? It's at 3:30. He said,
Yeah, I guess.
But it came out as an airless rasp, and he had to repeat himself. We're going to hook you up with a bullhorn, just like you wanted, because frankly, we're all getting kind of desperate here. But you'll wear protection. I insist on that. And we're going to have a select group of agents on the train, a few females, too, so it looks like the tourists are out again, because we don't want to make the suspect, Adam, I mean, suspicious. What could he say? The words were wadded in his throat. He needed water, needed breakfast, needed an aspirin.
So if he comes to me, you'll take him? Is that it? Is that the plan?
Listen, I don't want to risk any lives out there, and yes, that would be the ideal solution.
If I can get him to come.
Yeah, if.
And get him to put his gun down.
It's a big if, but I tell you, at this point, I'm willing to try anything. There was a silence.
And if he won't put it down? Assuming he even comes to the sound of my voice?
A sigh. The squawk of a radio in the background. I wouldn't want to speculate. The railroad was strictly a tourist thing now, though originally it had been used for bringing logs down to the mill at Fort Bragg, now defunct like everything else, and he hadn't been on it more than 3 or 4 times in his life. The skunk train. With its cartoon skunk logo that made everything seem so innocuous and appealing, though the nickname had come about because the train had originally burned crude oil for heat in the passenger car, and that left a sour odor hanging over the tracks. Half-day trips took you to North Spur from the coast, or down from Willits, up above. And you could see and document the redwoods without having to exert any more effort than it took to set down your wine glass and lift a camera off the seat. For his part, when he wanted to see the redwoods, he used his legs. And what he smelled out there wasn't crude oil or diesel or even wood smoke from the old steam engine they sometimes ran, but just what nature offered up. Not that he was critical or complaining. Every town needed an industry. And now that the mills were gone, this was the next best thing. Let the tourists go gaga over the big trees. Let them grow fat and fatter. It was fine with him. The first thing he did after he got off the phone with Rob was walk the three blocks into town for a big 20-ounce cafe latte with a double shot of espresso. The air dense, the sea swallowed up in fog. There were tourists everywhere, though the season was petering out, or should have been. But then the boomers were enjoying their retirement and didn't have a season anymore. They just kept coming. He would have gone to the bakery or the breakfast place to put something on his stomach, if only for ballast. But he didn't really want to see anybody, or have to make explanations or pretend to be grateful for the expressions of sympathy people kept laying on him, whether false or sincere or somewhere in between. Instead, he went to the deli and had them fix him a couple of sandwiches, one for now, one for the train. Then he went home to make his 100 daily phone calls in the frustrated hope of gleaning some bit of information that would provide the key here, the key he could turn in a lock that would open the door and make all of this go away. Just yesterday, he'd heard from the source at the Fort Bragg police station, Freddie Allen, who graduated from high school in 1982, that a witness had positively identified Adam the night before. The witness, a man in his 20s, one of those free spirits who didn't worry much about grooming and slept rough, and had a drug and or drinking problem, was making his own camp off the railroad tracks up near the South Fork milepost. And while he wasn't oblivious to the sheriff's order, he just didn't think it applied to him. It was unclear whether he knew Adam or not, but he was heading back from town along the tracks with a bottle of fortified wine and saw a figure coming toward him, moving fast, and recognized Adam. The thing was, Adam didn't seem jumpy or paranoid at all. In fact, he'd stopped and chatted with the man a while, even going so far as to share a joint with him in a thicket not 50 feet off the tracks, where transients were known to gather. Was the man afraid for his life? Well, no, he wasn't. For one thing, he was drunk, and for another, he expressed nothing but admiration for what Adam was doing, sticking it to them. And they were brothers. That was how he saw it. Adam must have seen it that way, too.
You know, the man told him, they're out here looking for you like a million cops.
Adam just shrugged. Let them look, he said. And how had this man come to let the police in on the encounter? Had he strolled in voluntarily to offer up information, maybe in the hope of scoring some reward money? No. He was arrested for urinating in public when he went back into town later that night for a second bottle. And as the arresting officer was handcuffing him, he happened to let it drop. Whether out of civic duty or by way of extenuation wasn't clear.
I don't know if it means anything to you, he said,
the words thick in his mouth.
But I just saw that dude you're after, Adam, like 2 hours ago.
So yes, Sten was making phone calls, and whether they led to anything other than frustration, more frustration, at least he was doing something. He spent the next 2 hours on the phone learning nothing, then thought to call Carolee before he left for the train, just to let her know what was going on. She picked up on the first ring, and right away he could tell something was wrong, just from the way she murmured hello, as if it had to be pried from her lips.
What is it? He said. You hear anything?
It took her a minute. She was gathering herself, her breathing harsh and sodden, as if she were holding a washcloth over the receiver.
They shot the antelope.
Who? What are you talking about?
Two of the Sable, Karina and Lulu, they're saying Adam did it.
Adam? That's ridiculous. It's 40 miles to get down there.
She didn't say anything to this. Just breathed through the line.
It's probably nothing. Some kid with a gun.
A pause. Her voice so reduced it was barely there. Adam's a kid with a gun.
Some other kid. Some apprentice Yahoo. It's nothing, I'm sure of it.
Uh-huh. Tell that to Cindy. And Gentian. They've got two dead animals on their hands. Animals that might as well have been over in Africa taking their chances there.
He didn't know what to say to this. Adam could easily have humped those 40 miles in the last 2 days, but Sten was sure he hadn't. And even if he had, why would he shoot antelope? But then, and Sten's thoughts were racing ahead of him, why would he shoot Carrie or Art or open fire on a SWAT team? The answer came rising to the surface like something buoyed on its own gases. Because he was suicidal. That was why. Because he wanted to die. He wasn't going to come to the train. To the sound of his own name, to his father. That was fantasy. That was futility. That was the way to pain. And more pain.
I'm sorry, he said. I am, really. That's a terrible thing. But I'm sure it's not Adam. I'm sure there's some other explanation. But look, the reason I called is I heard from Rob, and he wants me to go up the train line.
When?
Today. This afternoon.
I'm coming.
You heard Rob, didn't you? Bullets are flying out there. And whether these cops are highly trained or not, you never can tell what's going to happen, so that's just not an option.
And you really think he's going to listen to you? He's going to come to you? Because I'm the one. I'm the one he'll come to.
Yeah, he said. I know that. And here was the accusation again. The old thrust. Why can't you be a better father? Why can't you be home nights? Why can't you get strict with him? Lay down the law. Make him stop this nonsense. Why didn't you show up for the t-ball game, the sing-along, the cake sale? Because what meeting is more important than your own son?
And if I didn't know it, I'm sure you'd be there to tell me the next 10,000 times.
The train moved along at a walking pace, easing across the intersection on Main with its whistle blowing for everybody to hear and take note of. Whether they were stalled at the crossing in their cars and campers, or hunkered in some ravine halfway up the mountainside ready to take on the world. Sten was dressed like a tourist, in shorts, running shoes, and a woolen shirt that concealed the soft body armor Rob had insisted on, though it wasn't quite clear why, since it wouldn't stop a round from an assault rifle. Slow it down, maybe, depending on how far it had to travel. Or a ricochet. It might stop a ricochet, which, of course, might not necessarily cooperate and strike you where you were protected. It could go anywhere. Through your skull, the roof of your mouth, your groin. But he didn't want to think about that. Or the last time he'd laid eyes on Adam, the fight they'd had. How Adam had shoved back with all the sick fury uncoiling inside him. And what had the Norse called their fiercest warriors? Berserkers. They didn't know fear. They were unhinged. And on the battlefield, they went berserk. Adam Stenson. Sten's son. Son of Sten who was the son of Sten. There was no one on the deck of the observation car. That would have been suicidal in Rob's estimation. Rob, who'd declined to go on this little expedition because he had a command to oversee. And Sten wondered about that. About the imposture they were trying to pull off here. Various deputies were scattered throughout the two enclosed cars, men and women both, dressed casually, the men in loud shirts and reversed baseball caps, the women in big straw hats and pastels. But if they were really tourists, actual tourists, half of them would have been lounging around the open car, beer bottles pressed to their lips and cameras flashing. Would Adam notice? Would he care? Would he even be anywhere near the rail line in broad daylight? And here, despite himself,
he felt a flush of pride. Adam was smart. He was elusive. And he knew his terrain.
He would have made a lerp in Vietnam. The ghost in the night who materialized amongst the enemy to cut the throats of the unwary and scare the shit out of the rest. The train rattled on, picking up speed but still going at half the normal pace, because it was a target, and make no mistake about that, a lure, a bait. But then why would Adam want to shoot up a train or go anywhere near it? Sten had no answer to that, except that Adam had a rage inside him, and that rage had to come up against something. Just to rub it, feel it, let the world know what it was to have a thing like that clawing to get out. He'd felt it himself when he was in his teens, and after too, and he'd seen it channeled through two generations of cynical, slouching, bullheaded kids at the high school, of which Deputy Jason Ringwald, seated two rows behind him and staring hard out the window, was a prime example. Most of them suppressed it, and went out into the world to become cops and corporate raiders, army lifers, mill hands, but some never could get loose of it, and they wound up in jail, crippled in motorcycle accidents or scattered across the blacktop in pieces, or shot dead. "Any time now," a voice was saying, and he looked up to see one of the SWAT team honchos, a lieutenant, all eyebrows and a mouth pursed around a set of small, even teeth, hovering over the seat. They were passing along Pudding Creek, which was tidal here and had been used to float logs during rainy seasons of the past, but was now a swampy stretch of nothing you could barely turn a canoe around in. There were houses up on the hills, roads, the gleam of a parked automobile.
"Here?" he said. "We're barely out of town."
The man, he was in his late 30s, 40s maybe, with flecks of gray stubble along his jawline where he'd shaved hurriedly, just gave him a look. This man didn't trust him, didn't like him. None of them did. He was the father of the shooter, and that made him damaged goods. And if he wasn't a suspect, in their eyes he should have been.
"Might as well. You never know where he could be. Didn't they spot him along here night before last?"
"That's what I hear."
The cop held the look.
"It's costing time and money. For the engineer up there, the two of them, and us, all of us." He gave it a beat. "We got families too, you know."
Sten shrugged and rose to his feet, the megaphone clutched in one hand. He was planning to go out there on the observation car, no matter what anybody said. And if his son wanted to shoot him, if Adam wanted to shoot his own father, well, let him go ahead. Anything would be better than this. Until he stepped out on the deck, he hadn't realized how stifling it had been in the car. The air was in motion here, blowing cool on his face and drying the nervous sweat under his arms. He smelled bay, alder, pine, smelled mud and standing water, the dark funk of rot that underlay everything. The train swung round a curve, heading east now, heading uphill, and he caught a glimpse of a hidden glen thick with moss and fern, the light sifting through the trees in a luminous haze that made him forget for a moment just exactly what the purpose of all this was. He braced his hips instinctively against the sway of the platform and let the world open up around him, thinking how ungenerous he'd been to dismiss the tourists. Who could blame them for wanting to come up here, where it was silent and green, and the trees had stood motionless since the time before Christ, at least the ones the loggers hadn't gotten to? The air rushed at him. The tracks sang. He found he'd gone outside himself for a minute there, and it took the weight of the hard plastic butt of the bullhorn to bring him back. But then he raised the thing to his lips, feeling foolish and afraid, and maybe a little fatalistic too, because they were just wasting their time here, weren't they? He called Adam's name, but nothing happened because he'd somehow neglected to switch the thing on. Behind him, a small army sat balanced over their weapons, watching him. He found the switch, flicked it, and called his son's name, bellowed it, chanted it, threw it up against the changeless trunks of the trees till it came back to him riding on its own echo. And he kept on calling it,
all the way up the line and back down again, as the shadows deepened and his voice dried up to a hoarse, reverberant rattle in the very deepest hollow of his throat. Part 11. Route 20. 33. You mind if we just eat in front of the wood stove tonight? She was in the kitchen, cooking, calling over her shoulder to where Christabel sat in the rocker in the living room, the latest Cosmos spread open in her lap, and a glass of Chardonnay she'd brought along dangling from one hand. It's so much cozier in there, what with all this rain and all, don't you think? Christabel was giving her a faraway look, half-looped already. She didn't answer. We don't have to stand on formality, do we? No, no way, Christabel said, rousing herself. This would be one of the nights where Krista slept over. She could see that already. Right here's fine with me. Better than fine. Now I won't even have to move. You expect me to serve you? Damn straight I do. I am the guest, after all, aren't I? I mean, I serve you at my house. They were teasing back and forth, bantering. And it was perfect. Just what she needed. The fire going in the stove, rain at the windows, Katya curled up asleep on the rug, and dinner 3 shakes from being done. Right, she called, pausing to take a sip of her own wine, and then douse the fish with the rest of it. And when was the last time that happened? She was cooking up the 2 dozen smelt one of her clients had given her. He was rich, in his 60s, and when he wasn't riding, he was out on his boat, catching fish. And they were the simplest thing in the world. Gut them, wash them, roll them in flour, and sauté them whole with a little salt and pepper. High protein, low cal. She was serving a garden salad on the side, and those Pillsbury dinner rolls that took 15 minutes in the oven. After dinner, they'd watched one of the DVDs she'd checked out of the library on her way back with the fish. Or maybe both of them. One a so-called comedy and the other horror. Though she didn't much feel like horror tonight. Maybe they'd just turn in early. And if Adam had snuck out of the house yesterday morning before she even got up, and took the bourbon with him too, she wasn't missing him. Not with Christabel here, and everything so slow and calm and easy. Or that was what she told herself, anyway. He'd show up when he was ready. And this was the kind of weather that made camping a pure misery, so most likely it wouldn't be long. But let him take his time. She wasn't tied to him. She had a whole life of her own. When he showed, he showed. Why worry about it? She tipped the fish onto a serving plate and set the plate on the table next to the salad, then pulled the rolls from the oven, letting the sweet, warm, wafting scent of them fill the kitchen, even as the rain whispered on the roof and feathered the windows. You want water? She called. What would the French say? This was one of their jokes, having once been suckered into watching a French movie on Netflix that had gotten good reviews but turned out to be all but incomprehensible despite the subtitles, because the French, they concluded, had different values. The French would say, non. They'd say, pour me some more wine. Oui, oui, Christabel said, rising from the chair now. More wine. They pulled 2 chairs up to the stove, the door of which she'd left open so they could watch the fire crackling inside, and settled in, plates in laps. Katya was interested suddenly, and though she told herself she wouldn't have him begging, she couldn't help feeding him a sliver or two of fish in between bites. He took it daintily, with the softest jaws in the world, bolted it down and looked up expectantly for the next morsel to come his way. This is good, Christabel said, as if she doubted herself. Really good. I don't think I've ever... I mean, the whole fish. You don't think about it, though, do you? After the first one. Christabel, chewing, staring into the stove, just nodded. This was the kind of meal Sarah loved. No chemicals, no BHT, or food coloring, or, the worst, corn syrup. Just natural food. Come by naturally. Except for the rolls. But she didn't have the time or energy to make them from scratch, having worked outside in the rain half the day. But the fish were fresh caught right down there on the coast, and the butter lettuce, cherry tomatoes, Cucumbers and radishes had come from her own garden, and the fish were free, which made it even better, free for the taking, like mussels. She loved nothing better than to just pull over and make her way down a path to the sea at low tide, cut a bunch of mussels from the rocks, but not in summer, when they were quarantined because of the possibility of paralytic shellfish poisoning, which was fatal, thank you, and then steam them up and serve half as a starter with butter and garlic and homemade bread, and then toss the rest into a pot of marinara at the last minute so you didn't have to worry about them getting overcooked and rubbery. And berries. Nothing better than gathering berries in late summer for pies and tarts. But then you had the calorie factor to worry about. Berries with a little half and half then, and the smallest sprinkle of sugar. When they were done, Christabel insisted on washing the dishes, but she told her no, just let them sit. Because why spoil the evening with something so, what was the word, boring? Or no, tedious. Too tedious, she said. And she liked the sound of it and added, don't be tedious. Let's be the opposite. What is the opposite of tedious anyway? Christabel let out a laugh. I don't know. Untedious? They talked about having an after-dinner drink. Baileys. She had some Baileys in the cabinet, but that stuff packed on the pounds like steroids. They ought to give that to the cattle at the feedlots, she said. That'd fatten them up pronto. Yeah, Christabel said, giving her a sloppy grin. But what would the French say? They'd say, make mine rare. Right. And then they'd say, let's stick to wine. So they stuck to wine. How many glasses, neither of them could say. But the quantity turned out to be exactly the precise amount to make the so-called comedy funny. Or that is, to prime them to the point where they could get sarcastic and laugh at it. Which, as it turned out, made it genuinely funny. They were both laughing when they heard the sirens. And before they could even get up out of their chairs, or pause the video or shut the stove so they wouldn't have to worry about sparks, the front door, which had been locked, she was pretty sure it had been locked, burst open as if it was made of cardboard, and there were cops everywhere, shouting, your hands! Let me see your hands! She'd been a fool. That was her first thought, worse than a fool. Because she, of all people, should have known they'd never let it go. Because once they got their claws into you, you had no more status than they did. And not packing up and moving to Nevada when she had the chance was just about the stupidest thing she'd ever done. What was wrong with her? What had she been thinking? That they'd forget about it? That if she stuck around, Adam would give up on the woods and come back to her? That it would be too hard, too much of an effort to pull up her stakes here? She'd been lazy. That's what it was. Living in fantasy land, and she was getting just what she deserved, because here they were with their boots and guns and bulletproof vests, and there was no way out now. She had her hands in the air. Christabel, who looked as if she'd been flash frozen, had dropped the wine glass on the rug in the shock of the moment, and she had her hands in the air too. And Kutya was going bonkers. Lady, one of the cops yelled at her, will you control that animal? At first, she couldn't understand what he was saying because they'd come to take Kutya away from her, hadn't they? Wasn't that what this was all about? That and maybe her no-show on the seatbelt thing. And the court date on the trumped-up DUI charge, to which she'd pleaded innocent, but that wasn't for 2 weeks yet. Not that she had any intention of showing for it, or hadn't had, until now. But wait, and here her blood froze. What about that little incident the other night with the police cruiser and the sugar water meant for the innocent hummingbirds? They'd caught her on videotape, she was sure of it, because everything in the USIGA was on tape now, every breath you took. And what about the Fourth Amendment? What about that? Search and seizure? Hello? Kutya, she called. Kutya, stop it now! But when she tried to get up out of the chair and take him by the collar, the cop shoved her back down. Hands! He roared. And he had his gun trained right on her. She was scared. Had never been so scared in her life. But she couldn't help throwing it back at him nonetheless. How am I supposed to control him if I can't even... Shut the fuck up! That's what he said, or snarled. And then another cop had one of those muzzle things on a stick and seized hold of the dog's snout, and the barking abruptly stopped. It was right around then that she began to reconsider. There were cops everywhere, stalking through the kitchen, the bedrooms, their guns held out rigidly before them, and laser lights poking red holes in everything. But why? Why would there be such a show of force over a woman who wasn't wearing her seatbelt? Even if she hadn't shown for her court date. Even if they knew she'd destroyed a police car, which it became obvious to her in that moment they didn't. Another cop was there now. A bald-headed one, tailed by a deputy who looked all of 12 years old. And why did everybody have to shave their heads? Was it some sort of cops and robbers sort of thing? He stood there a moment, just out of range of the one who'd pinned Kutya down with the muzzle stick, staring at her. "Sarah Hoverty Jennings?" he asked. She couldn't do much more than just nod yes, her heart going like the Stairmaster said on Alpine. But the words were on her lips. Threat, duress, and coercion. And if he didn't back off, she was going to start screaming, and they could just go ahead and shoot her. But she surprised herself by finding her voice long enough to frame her own question in as nasty a voice as she could muster. "You got a search warrant?" The cop ignored her. He swung his head in Christabel's direction, Christabel, who was sitting right there beside her, her hands in the air still. "And what's your name?" Poor Krista. She was so scared she could barely talk, or she couldn't. She couldn't talk at all. "You can put your hands down," he said, softening his voice. "Both of you." He was short, this cop, as nondescript as if he had his face on backwards, but he seemed to be in charge. And he had some sort of decoration or whatever it was sewed to the shoulder of his uniform. "Now, once again, you," nodding at Christabel. "I asked your name."
"Christabel Walsh. I'm a teacher's aide."
She started to say where she worked, as if the name of the school would carry any weight, but her voice got choked in her throat and she couldn't go on. And now one of the other cops, the one who'd been in the bedroom going through her personal things, clomped into the room and announced, "All clear back there. Nobody here but these two. You go out there and check that yard, every blade of grass, hear me? Fence lines, all the fields around here, get the dogs on it." "Yes, sir." And that cop was gone, out the door and into the yard where the lights were at war and voices stalked around the corners. It was then, just then in the interval before the chief cop turned back to her, that she began to understand. "Is this about Adam?" she asked. And why she asked, she didn't know. It was just some snaky intuition that made her heart hammer even faster and the fish go sour on her stomach. At first, the cop questioned them both together, but then, after he'd asked Christabel what sort of person Adam was, and she'd said,
"I don't know, regular, I guess, maybe a little weird. He's a nudist, I mean, sometimes, anyway."
The cop called one of his men over and said, "Why don't you take her out in the kitchen and see what she knows? I'll take care of Sarah here myself." What he did then, with the lights flashing outside and cops all over the place, as if this was some kind of war zone, was plunk himself down in the chair Christabel had just vacated, then scoot it over so that he was right there in her face, their knees practically touching. "You know, Sarah, is it all right if I call you Sarah? You know, I don't really think we have to get upset here or anything, or take this down to the station either. I just want to ask you a couple questions. About Adam.
What did he do?"
"Why don't you just let me ask the questions, okay? This doesn't have to be hard. It's not going to be hard. As long as you cooperate, you understand me?" What she felt then, under threat, duress, and coercion like nobody could believe, was just the faintest breath of release. They hadn't come for her. They didn't care about her or her dog either. All they wanted was Adam. But why? What had he done? Sitting there knee to knee with the cop, and the fire snapping and Christabel shunted away to the kitchen with another cop, she tried to picture him, and what she saw was his body greased with sweat, his arms, his bare arms and the knife at his side, and the gun. The gun. You saw him last when? 2 nights ago, is that right? Wednesday? She just nodded. She flashed on that day in the car, the day she'd met him, when he'd gone ballistic over the side of a cop car going in the opposite direction. But what had he done? They wouldn't bring 1,000 cops around to swarm all over her if it wasn't the worst. But what was the worst? What was the worst thing you could do? She felt her scalp prickle. She could barely breathe.
And he left Thursday morning, early, before you were up?
Yes.
He say where he was going?
I don't know. The woods? I think he was, like, living out there.
What about his rifle? Did he take his rifle? Did he leave it here? With him, I mean.
He always had it.
The cop was silent a minute, as if mulling this over. Adam and his rifle. Then he leaned in nearer so that she could see his eyes up close. The little dance of his pupils. You took him to the hospital.
Why was that? He asked me to. He had the runs, Giardia.
Kutya had been still. But now, in the far corner of the room, he began struggling again, though the cop there held him firmly down.
This isn't right, she said. I don't have to talk to you, and I'm not going to say one more word until you tell me what this is all about.
Another silence, longer this time. The way he was watching her creeped her out, as if he was some kind of god looking down on the littlest thing in his creation, a bug or bacterium, when in fact he was just another tool of the system. You want to get cute? I can arrest you right this minute. She didn't want to push it, but she couldn't help herself, because this was just sick. The whole slimy police state Heil Hitler crap that had brought Jerry Kane down and was bringing her down too.
For what?
Oh, I don't know, he said, shrugging. Accessory to murder? How does that sound? Everything seemed to stop right then. The stomping, the hollering, the banging of her heart and the whimpering of the dog, replaced by a long slither of white noise hissing in her ears. What the cop told her was that Adam had shot somebody while he was on his sojourn out there in the woods. Shot him and left him for dead. And that everybody had thought the Mexicans had done it. But it wasn't the Mexicans at all. It was Adam. Proof positive. Adam had shot somebody, and then he'd got sick, and come to her, to her bed. And she'd washed his clothes for him, and let him make love to her, and he never even so much as mentioned it. As if people were nothing. As if you could just go around shooting, and then drink bourbon, and cook beef stew over a campfire as if it was the most ordinary thing in the world. She didn't know what to say. She was in shock. And don't pretend you don't know where he is. You had a relationship with him. For what, 2, 3 months now?
I told you, she said. He's in the woods.
You getting smart with me? Because if you want to get smart, we can continue this down at the station.
No. She said. Really, I don't know where he is. I mean, other than that. I told you, he left here yesterday morning, and I haven't seen him since. Or heard from him.
Really?
And yet you took him to the hospital for medication.
Yes, but I didn't.
That makes you an accessory, right there.
I didn't know.
You didn't know he killed an unarmed man in cold blood?
She shook her head.
Or today?
What about today? You know he killed another man today, right this afternoon? While you were what, knitting?
It was all too much. She didn't have to listen to this. Whoever said she had to listen to this? He was a liar. He was just trying to get to her because he was the criminal, not Adam.
I don't knit, she said. And I have no contract with you. How many times do I have to tell you people?
Kutya squirmed. He let out a low growl and the lights flashed in the yard. She shot a furious glance round the room, the cops, the poor dog. Christabel, where was Christabel?
You know what you are? She said.
He just sat there, his lips zipped tight, trying to burn his eyes right through her.
You're just an actor, that's all. Somebody in a costume. Like you're dressed up for Halloween. And you know something else? I'm not into trick-or-treating.
34. In the end, they must have believed her. And Christabel, too. Christabel, who by that point was scared sober and wearing a face like something she'd picked up off the floor. Because eventually, they took their muddy boots and clanking belts and double-barreled shotguns and faded back into the night, but not without taking two plastic bags of what they called evidence with them, and leaving a patrol car just down the street with its lights off, and two cops inside to see if she was going to run out into the woods, find her way to Adam and somehow warn him off, which she would have if she could, because it was all lies. And if you had to pick sides here, she knew which one she was on. Adam never hurt anybody. And even if he did, even if it was true, whoever it was probably had it coming. The cops left a vacuum behind them. Whoosh, all the air sucked right out of the place. One minute the house was an armed camp, and the next it was deserted. It also left a mess. Her clothes were scattered around the bedroom, drawers pulled out, closets yawning open. The kitchen floor was all tracked up, and they'd left it that way, because what did they care about free men on the land, and personal property, or individual rights, or anything else for that matter? But she didn't have the heart to take a mop to it before she went to bed, and when she woke up from a night's worth of poisonous dreams, she didn't have the energy. Ditto for Christabel, who at least didn't have to go into work, thank God, because it was Saturday. When she got up and came into the kitchen at something like 6:30, Christabel was already sitting there at the table drinking black coffee and staring out the window. She was wearing a t-shirt she'd managed to put on backwards under a cardigan that hung loose over her butt and bare thighs. Last night's makeup caking under her eyes, and her hair looking as if she'd been fighting a windstorm all night long. Kutya lay curled up under the table, his dreadlocks filthy from the mud out in the yard, the mud on the floor for that matter, and he never even lifted his head when she stepped into the room. Christabel didn't turn to look at her. She didn't say hi or good morning. All she said was,
"Jesus, I don't think I've ever been through anything like that. Not in my whole life. Not even that time I was in the accident."
"Me either."
"I was so scared."
All she could do was nod. She went to the counter and poured herself a cup of coffee, then lightened it with a splash of milk and stirred in 2 heaping teaspoons of sugar, real sugar and not that artificial crap. She'd worry about calories later. Calories were the least of her problems.
"You know, you can't say I didn't warn you."
And here Christabel turned to look up at her out of bloodshot eyes. Eyes that weren't even that pretty, really, but just a dull, fixed brown. She just shook her head very slowly, the injustice of it all settling on her like a coat made out of lead, like one of those things they make you wear when they take x-rays of your chest.
"Yeah? You warned me, all right. But since when do I have to listen?" "Oh, Christ, you're not going to defend him, are you? He's a nutcase. He killed 2 people. He could have killed us."
"So the cops say."
"You believe the cops?"
She saw now that Christabel was holding something in her left hand, a slice of color, the sharp, concentrated gleam of the cloud sucked down to earth, her cell phone.
"I believe this," she said.
And there it was, Adam's face staring out of the phone. Adam's face everywhere on every site. Proof run wild. He'd shot and killed 2 men. And here were their faces, their names and biographies. And she realized with a jolt that she knew one of them from the high school. And how strange it was to think he was dead. Slain. And would never walk those corridors again or stand before a class of kids who might have loved him or hated him, but had the same festering hormones and the same issues the class before them had had, and the class after them would have, and all the classes before and since. He was dead. Art Tolleson. He was dead, and Adam had killed him. She went into the living room and flicked on the TV, and it was on every channel. the sheriff, and it was his face on the screen now. The poser with the grappling hook eyes, who'd sat right there in her own house and harassed her for the better part of an hour, was giving a press conference and telling everybody to stay calm even though he was cordoning off the entire forest range, from the Middle Fork of the 10 Mile in the north to the Big River in the south, coast to mountains, and that no one was to be allowed in for any purpose whatever until the threat had been neutralized. And what about Route 20? Route 20 was a major artery, as was the Coast Highway, and they would remain open to traffic. But he cautioned people not to linger or get out of their cars. The suspect was armed and dangerous, and if anyone encountered him or knew anything of his whereabouts, they should call 911. Then up came the picture of Adam. Full screen. A picture, she realized, that must have been a mugshot from one of his past brushes with the system. But the thing was, he didn't look anything like Adam. Not the Adam she knew. He looked like a thug. With his shaved head and one eye half closed as a result of whatever struggle he must have put up when they were trying to take him into custody. And they must have gang-piled him, because he was a rock, and he could have taken on any three of them all by himself. But then that was no way to think. The way to think was of how to cut him loose. All knowledge and memory of him. To forget him and move on. To Nevada. The sooner the better. Okay, she said, nodding at Christabel, who joined her in front of the TV. You were right. I admit it. And I should never have even thought about dating him. Christabel made a little noise of disapproval in her throat. I've said it before. She gave her a sharp glance out of those mud-brown eyes with their dead eyeliner and faded mascara. Christabel the Righteous. Christabel in the aftermath, picking through the wreckage. I never could tell what you saw in him anyway. A week went by, then another. Her court date came up, and if she thought anything about it at all, it was just that she regretted the waste of ink it took to mark her calendar, when she had no intention of going anywhere near the courthouse, or the police station, or any place else the pretenders pretended to conduct their so-called business. Still, though, and this nagged at her, she hadn't even taken step one as to getting herself out of Dodge, and you had to chalk that up to inertia. That and grief. She was grieving over Adam, over how she'd fallen so hard for him when clearly he was trouble, worse than trouble, a psychopath, a murderer, a cannon so loose he'd rolled right off the deck. But that was the problem. She had fallen for him, and nothing could change that. Adam. He was all anybody could talk about. On the news every night. National news now. At large for 18 days and counting. People called her out of the blue. Clients. Friends she'd forgotten she had. Reporters. They all wanted to know what she knew. Wanted details. Gossip. Dirt. What it all boiled down to, no surprise, was sex, though nobody came straight out and said it. How could she have had sex with a maniac? That was what they wanted to know. How could she have kissed him, invited him into her bed, and more, and juicier? What was it like? Was it good? Was it hot? Did he get rough? When she went out, she tried to keep a low profile, wearing bulky clothes and a hat. Always a hat. But she did have to work, after all. No subbing, though, no way, not with all this notoriety. And when she went to her clients' houses, just to see their poor, dumb horses that wouldn't have known or cared if she'd gone to bed with 100 maniacs, with the Taliban or the whole U.S. Army, she couldn't have a moment's peace. Here were these people she'd known for years, women mostly, decent people, her clients, for Christ's sake. And they just draped themselves right over her while she manipulated her hoof pick and clinch cutters, sniffing and probing and working at her like paleontologists looking for the bones revealed in the dirt. Then one day she went down to work at the Burnsides, because the Burnsides were marked on her calendar, and she had to earn a living no matter what the rest of the world was doing or thinking or saying. There were cops everywhere, as if it was some sort of convention. but she tried to ignore them, because they weren't there for her. And when she came into Calpurnia, the fog, which had pretty well curtained everything in to this point, got denser suddenly, so dense she had to put her lights and wipers on. She almost went right on by the turnoff, but caught herself at the last minute. There was nobody else on the road. Even here, 40 miles south, Adam had managed to cast a pall over things, because they couldn't catch him. He was too smart for them, too hard. They'd sent all those SWAT teams out there, helicopters with their infrared tracking devices, dogs, the very dogs Roger had told her about. Good dog. Good dog. And he'd outmaneuvered them all. When she swung into Cindy's driveway, the gravel giving way under her wheels, she saw there was another car parked there in front of the barn. Not Cindy's or Jenshin's, but one that looked familiar somehow. Whose was it? The answer would come to her the minute she pulled up beside it, shut down her engine, and climbed out of the car with her toolkit. It was Adam's mother's car. Carolee's. Because here came Carolee marching out of the mist with Cindy and Jenshin flanking her. The two of them looking as if they were going to war while she looked like she'd just been punched in the gut. Hi, Sarah said, though Adam's mother was somebody she could definitely have done without seeing. Jenshin, a big man, once powerful but now gone to seed around the face that drooped in folds right on down into the collar of his shirt, stopped in his tracks, and the woman pulled up then too. The look he was giving her was fierce, outraged. He spat out the words. He shot Karina and Lulu. Who? What are you talking about? Cindy answered for him. Adam! They all looked to Carolee, the mother. But Carolee had nothing to say. Either an affirmation or denial. She was having enough trouble keeping her face composed. What she'd done, Sarah could see this in a flash, was come down here to help out, to do something, anything, to get away from the terrible tension at home that must have been even worse for her than it was for herself. She'd given birth to him, breastfed him, potty trained him, held his hand when he went to kindergarten, and agonized over every inappropriate display and skewed adjustment through what must have been a chaotic childhood to a squirrely adolescence, and now this. They were hunting her son, and he was their quarry, no different from the deer the sportsmen bungee-strapped to the hoods of their cars. And who hadn't seen the blood there, striping the windshield and tarnishing the bright, resistant strips of chrome? In that moment, Sarah went outside herself and saw what this woman, her enemy who'd rejected her right from the start, was going through. She said, "It wasn't Adam."
"How the hell would you know?"
Jenshin still hadn't moved, but she could see how furious he was, his fists clenched, the old splayed muscles tightening on their cords, something working beneath the skin at the corner of one eye.
"Did you see him? Did you ask him?"
"It wasn't Adam," Cindy said.
"He's on foot, gent. It's 40 miles.
The picture of Karina came into her head then. Not the big-ribbed corpse she'd see bloodied in the field in due course, but Karina after she'd had her first calf, proud and watchful and erect on her stiffened legs, her ears up and her nostrils to the wind. A dog had appeared at the periphery of the meadow one afternoon 1,000 yards away, a dog on a leash being walked along the street on the far side of the fence. No threat at all, not if she understood the situation. But Karina didn't understand the situation. Karina had perceived the danger in the way the light scissored between those four trotting legs, and she charged halfway across the field, flinging up turf with her savage cutting hooves that could have decapitated that dog in a heartbeat, and maybe his owner too. That was instinct. That was all she knew.
40 miles, shit,
Jenshin spat, turning bitterly on his wife.
You tell me who else is crazy enough to shoot defenseless animals like this? Who else is out there killing things with a rifle, huh? Tell me that.
No one answered him. The fog lifted, and fell in beaded threads and tugged at the light in waves that seemed to pulsate across the yard. The gravel shone with wet. Gentian was red-faced. Cindy looked ashamed. And Carolee? Carolee looked as if she'd never expected her feelings to be spared again. Looked like a pariah. Mother of the murderer. And what did that say about her, then? She was the girlfriend, no denying it. And that made her guilty, too. As guilty in their eyes as if she'd pulled the trigger herself.
35. It was midway through the fifth week. Adam was still at large and the police were beyond crazy. They were stopping everybody on Route 20 just to look in their cars because in their feeble minds they imagined Adam squeezed under somebody's seat or packed into their trunk, and they'd stopped her three times now, but it was nothing more than a petty annoyance. They didn't ask for her papers, and she didn't have to state her status. They didn't care if she was wearing a seatbelt or not, and they didn't run her license plate or turn up the warrant out for her arrest on the grounds that she'd refused to play their idiot games or shuffle one more time through the charade of authority. With the old hag of a judge in her courthouse, presided over by the flag of the USIGA. No. All they were interested in was Adam. It was all-out war now. They'd been made to look like the fools they were, big macho men with their big manly guns, and all the resources of 10 sheriff's departments, and they still couldn't catch one 25-year-old mountain man who was driving a stake through the heart of the local economy and scaring the bejesus out of the taxpayers so they couldn't even sleep at night. She was at home, in the kitchen, listening to music and pushing two bone-in pork chops around a pan and sprinkling them with rosemary from her garden. She was tired of salad, so she'd bought some fresh spinach at the farmer's market, rinsed it, tossed it with a little garlic salt and pepper, then splashed it with olive oil and balsamic, and microwaved it for 3 minutes. Easiest thing in the world. It had fallen dark now, the nights growing shorter and colder, and Halloween just 2 days away. How would that play out, she wondered. What would parents tell their children? They'd have private parties, she supposed. Because no one, absolutely no one, would be going house to house. Not with Adam out there. Would he consciously hurt a kid? Not the Adam she knew. But then he had driven his car onto the playground, hadn't he? And maybe he wasn't really the Adam she knew. Not if he could shoot down Art Tolleson and the other one and just leave them there to rot. Kutya stirred in the corner, where he'd been lying asleep, laziest dog she'd ever seen, and not getting any younger. And now he came clicking across the floor to her, and the smell of the meat searing in the pan. No, she told him, bending from the waist to look into his eyes. You're just going to have to wait. Then she turned back to the pan and flipped the chops, everything in its place and everything quiet. But here she was in her warm kitchen, with the smell of the meat rising around her, and she couldn't help wondering what Adam was eating. He had a prodigious appetite, and no matter how many freeze-dried entrees or cans of beef stew he'd squirreled away out there, how could it have lasted him all this time? He'd been breaking into cabins. They'd reported that. And he'd held that one lady hostage back there at the beginning, but still. And that was another thing. No hot food. Even when it was raining, even when it was cold, and it had been getting down into the 40s at night. Maybe he had a camp stove. The kind of thing you could risk cooking on in a deep, secluded place, a cave or something. But even so, he must have been pretty miserable. She tried to picture that a minute. Him in a cave, with that rank, wet smell caves always had, and what, bats hanging overhead? He wouldn't dare travel in the daytime. Not if he had any sense. And he did, obviously. So he must have been roaming the woods in the dark. And if he was, he couldn't use a light. And if he couldn't use a light, how could he find his way? Plus, how could he keep from dying of boredom out there? Even if he was putting everything he had into baiting the jerk-off cops and their killer dogs, and no doubt enjoying it, too. Adam. And why couldn't she stop thinking about him? Maybe because nobody else could, either. Anything went wrong within 100 miles, even a flat tire,
and Adam was to blame. Like with that whole debacle down at the Burnsides. How quick they were to pin that on him. Even with his mother, their friend, a woman who was just volunteering her time for God's sake, standing right there beside them. He shot the sable. That was what Jensen had said. Not someone shot the sable, but he shot them. The way it turned out, though, Adam had nothing to do with it. Of course, the cops were there within 5 minutes of Jensen's putting in the call, swarming all over everything, their faces haggard and desperate, because the system wasn't supporting them. The system was breaking down right in front of their eyes, and there was nothing they could do about it. They searched the edge of the field and came up with some shell casings, and they had one of their butchers slice open these beautiful 400-pound animals and dig the slugs out of them, and they tramped hell out of the place but didn't turn up Adam or anybody else. What they did discover finally, and they took their sweet time about disclosing it too, was that two junior high kids had been fooling around with a deer rifle one of them found in his father's gun safe, which had been left unlocked. They found something in the liquor cabinet, too, and thought it would be a great idea, or rad. Wasn't that what they would say, a rad idea? To go out and put holes in these beautiful animals that were fast disappearing from the earth. She sat at the table to eat, idly paging through one of the magazines Christabel had left behind for her. Krista was a real hound for the gossip sheets. Us Weekly, In Touch, People, The Star. But basically, they left her cold because it was just more of the same blindered attitude and slave mentality. As if whoever was dating whoever or buying what fabulous mansion had anything to do with the fact that the system was rotted all the way down to the stump. After dinner, she went to her computer and read the latest about Adam, which is basically nothing piled on top of nothing, limiting herself to half an hour, and then she tried to read by the wood stove for a while, Kutya curled up at her feet, and finally turned on the idiot box to see if maybe there was an old movie on, one of the ones where people, Jimmy Stewart, Gary Cooper, take your pick, made all these stirring declarations about democracy and standing up for the little man while the heroine flashed across the screen in all these killer outfits. It was crap. But high-minded crap. Crap in layers she could peel away till she found something there that took her back to a simpler time. A time before the corporations had taken over and made a mockery of everything everybody said on the screen. A movie. It was just a movie. A way to pass the time in an empty house on a night when there was nothing going on and the world had been reduced to these four walls and this gently ticking wood stove and the dog in his dreadlocks on the rug at her feet. The funny thing, or odd was a better word, was that it was just like the last time. Nothing moving, nothing shaking, but there was a feeling coming over her that she wasn't alone. She looked over her shoulder. There was no one there. The doors were locked, she was sure of it, and if anyone should try to get in, Kutya, old as he was, would be up and barking his head off. She turned back to the movie. Someone sitting by a deathbed on a ship. Flimsy walls that were just a stage set, and another movie playing through the porthole to give the illusion that the ship was moving, and this was all real. And then the feeling stole over her again, and she turned around and there he was. He didn't say hello, or help me, or I love you, but just stood there, like Adam, exactly like, only different because of what he'd done, and where he'd been, and how he'd been putting it to the cops for all these weeks now. Kutya didn't stir until he spoke, and even then he didn't bark because he must have remembered him, without prejudice, because he was only a dog. Adam said, "Turn out the lights." She said his name, but she didn't get up from the chair, though the dog had crossed the room to him, sniffing. "Do it," he said. She got up then, but she didn't go to him, instead working her way from lamp to lamp till the room was lit only by the TV. He looked older somehow, thinner, a lot thinner, and his clothes were ragged. She could smell the woods on him, the rot, as if he had been living in a cave, with the bats and the lice and the Giardia parasites. "Kill the TV too."
We'd be totally in the dark, she said. No, no way.
And then, standing poised there in front of the lamp over the desk, even as the glow of it faded away, she said,
What are you doing here anyway? Are you crazy? The cops are watching this place, don't you realize that?
He shrugged, dark in his dark clothes. There was a slash across his face, a welt there, fresh and livid, and the first thing she thought was that he'd been grazed by a bullet. But she saw that it wasn't that at all, more likely a mishap in the dark as he was creeping up on the place. He just stood there, his hands hanging at his sides. And where was his gun, his rifle? There, propped against the wall in the hallway that led to the back room. He looked exhausted, looked beat, beaten down. She began to fear for herself then, not out of fear of him, because she didn't care what he'd done. He would never hurt her, she was sure of it. But of the cops. If they found him here, if they found even the minutest scrap of evidence that he'd been here, then she was an accomplice, and all the shit they'd brought down on her already was nothing compared to what was coming.
What do you want? She demanded.
I'm hungry.
I can't give you food. I can't give you anything. They'll put me in jail.
Who? He said, his voice thick with contempt. The hostiles? The aliens?
And then he laughed, but it wasn't a happy laugh.
Not while I'm here, they won't.
You've got to get out of here, she said. They'll kill you.
He laughed again.
I'm not kidding, Adam. They've been here. They tore the whole place apart. You've got to go right now. Now, hear me?
You won't give me food?
No.
Coulter would have got food, he said. Coulter would have, she cut him off.
Enough with Coulter. Coulter has nothing to do with this. Coulter's dead. He's been dead for like 200 years, and the world isn't like that anymore. You know it. You of all people.
I want to sleep with you.
They were 10 feet apart, and he didn't come to her, and she didn't go to him. They were like statues, talking statues. That moment? That was the moment that tested her more than any other. And if she saw herself packing in a frenzy, and sneaking him and Kutya into the car and making a run for Stateline or wherever, Canada, it was because her heart was breaking. She was his mother too, his mother and his lover, and they were going to kill him.
No,
she said.
You have to get out. Get out and never come back.
The light of the TV flickered across his face, black and white. Somebody dying on a ship. And everything as false and artificial and make-believe as it could be.
Get out,
she said, fighting to control her voice.
If you don't get out, I'm going to call the police.
Really,
he said. And still he hadn't moved.
You'd really do that? Even to Coulter?
Yes, she said. Yes, even to Coulter.